What is the No Spin News all about?
You know that this is a fact-based analysis news program. You know that. We avoid speculation. We don't do conspiracies here. We don't do party politics here. We're not nonpartisan. That's wrong. Not that. Okay, we are advocates for a stronger America and a more just society. We don't believe in communism. We don't believe in socialism. We don't believe in nihilism. We don't believe in the progressive woke culture. We think it is un-American. We don't support that. So you should know what we are. And it would then crystallize what we do.
Listen to the No Spin News. Subscribe to Bill O'Reilly's podcast feed wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Josh Hammer, and welcome back to a Friday edition of America on Trial, your one-stop shop for all your legal news pertaining to the 2024 presidential election and all the major pressing legal headlines affecting our country and our American way of life. On today's show, a deep dive into the federal courtroom of Florida Judge Aileen Cannon, what is going on there when it comes to Donald Trump, a bit of a setback with his claim of the Presidential Records Act shielding him from prosecution there. We're going to get into all that and more in today's deep dive. Then later in the show, in today's closing argument as well, what's going on with the situation in Gaza? You had the left-wing celebrity chef Jose Andres send in some aid workers who were tragically killed in an accidental misfire from the Israeli military. Joe Biden is apoplectic about this. We're going to break through the fog and get it down to size for you. But first, as always, let's go around the horn. We begin in Washington, D.C. Just a brief reminder that on Monday is the deadline for Jack Smith, the federal special counsel, to file his brief in opposition to Donald Trump's own brief when it comes to the big immunity showdown at the United States Supreme Court coming up later this month on April 25th. That is the huge showdown. Mark your calendars. We are eagerly anticipating it here on America on Trial. It's going to get into the scope and breadth and depth of presidential immunity and whether or not Donald Trump is going to be immune from future criminal prosecution and really setting a precedent for future presidents in general when it comes to this thorny question. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in the unsigned per curiam opinion had a really sweeping ruling that is going to have to be considerably narrowed, I think, moving forward. We'll see what the Supreme Court does with it. But for now, Jack Smith is going to have to issue that filing with his brief in court on Monday. From Washington, D.C. out to Nebraska, of all states, we actually briefly check in Nebraska. You know, Charlie Kirk had an interesting point on Twitter this week. I certainly gave him a retweet. It was an astute point, and I'm happy that Charlie raised it. Nebraska is one of only two states in the country, along with Maine, that issues some of its electoral college votes based on congressional district. So it's not necessarily a winner-take-all like most states are. And Charlie basically raised the obvious question, which is, why are we doing this in Nebraska, where Republicans wield power in the unicameral legislature and in the governor's mansion, Governor Jim Pillen? Why are we doing this? I mean, Omaha is a blue-leaning city. Why would you basically just give the Democrats an electoral college vote? It doesn't really make a heck of a lot of sense, does it, where Republicans wield power and they can easily change this? So he called for this, and the governor quickly got behind it, Governor Jim Pillen. Unfortunately, in a procedural vote Wednesday evening by a 36-8 count, by my math, overwhelming lopsided vote, this was shot down. Now, it still could be raised in a special session after the legislative session ends. It's ending soon. But for now, just put that on your radar, that this is an interesting twist to the Electoral College math. Should be one easy Electoral College vote that should be able to be flipped easily from D to R. Amidst this modern precedent and what we're seeing right now with all the lawfare in front of us, surely something purely legal within the legitimate bounds of a state legislature to do this, to change the electoral college votes from congressional district allocation to winner take all, this strikes me as a deeply prudent and indeed overdue move. From Nebraska back to Washington, D.C., just a brief word and a terrible update for you. Jeffrey Clark, the former high-ranking Trump DOJ official, has been found in violation from a sham disciplinary panel of the District of Columbia Bar to have violated some unspecified ethics rule when it came to a memo that he drafted but never even sent, actually, in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election. All this might have the possible effect of leading to Jeffrey Clark's disbarment in Washington, D.C., which would be absolutely catastrophic and terrible. He, much like John Eastman, they are both also facing criminal prosecution as part of the Fonnie Willis probe down in Fulton County, Georgia. John Eastman is going through his own disbarment headache out in California. We've covered that here on America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Awful stuff. Ultimately, as I argue in my syndicated column out today, which you can find at Newsweek or any other right-of-center publication, as I argue today, all of this has the effect of amounting to a war on the legal profession. They ultimately do not want lawyers to represent high-profile Republicans or work in future Republican departments of justice, things like that. That is what all of this is about. It is a deliberate chilling effect on conservatives to possibly represent high-profile Republicans. It's disgusting, and it should be called out as that. Finally, the last bit of news in today's Around the Horn segment, we go down to Georgia, an unfortunate setback for Donald Trump in Judge Scott McAfee's courtroom in Georgia yesterday. The meat of that litigation is now pending before the appellate court. We need Fonnie Willis's motion to be filed before the appellate court as to why she should still not be disqualified. So we're waiting to hear all that at the appellate court. The appellate court there in Georgia still might actually rule that Fonnie Willis has to be dismissed, so we're waiting on clarity on that. But meanwhile, down in the trial court in Scott McAfee's Fulton County Superior Court courtroom yesterday, we did get a ruling. Donald Trump had been trying to get his prosecution there dismissed on free speech claims. He basically argued that this is free speech, this is First Amendment protected speech, and sure enough, it is. I'm not conceding this on the fact. Let's concede just for the sake of argument, as lawyers like to do. Let's concede arguendo for the sake of argument that the speech that Trump and his co-defendants said in Georgia in the aftermath of the 2020 election was false. Let's concede for the sake of argument that what Donald Trump said to Brad Raffensperger on the infamous January 3rd, 2021 phone call, let's concede that it was false. Guess what? You're allowed to lie in this country. You're literally allowed to lie with very, very limited dispensations to the contrary, such as the congressionally passed Stolen Valor Act and things like that. You are typically allowed to lie. Lying is not a crime. It might be morally dubious. It might be against various other sorts of moral and ethical injunctions, even biblical injunctions. But under U.S. code, it is not typically criminalized. So that was basically what Donald Trump and his co-defendants argued there in Georgia. And they're not wrong for doing so, but McAfee, the judge, is not currently having it. He is choosing not to dismiss on those grounds right now. But crucially, it is worth pointing out, he did have enough foresight and enough humility where he said that they could go ahead and try to raise this as a substantive defense during trial itself. Rather, he just said that they have no grounds with which to dismiss this pre-trial because of that. So a mixed bag in Georgia, but definitely at least a little bit of a setback. But we will wait and see what happens there, of course. Much to come in that Fonnie Willis prosecution in Georgia. Up next, we're going to talk about what happened in the federal courtroom of Judge Aileen Cannon in Fort Pierce, Florida. Big developments there yesterday. Also, unfortunately, not great news for Donald Trump. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike Slater from the podcast Politics by Faith. This is a crazy time in our country. It's stressful, a lot of anxiety, and it's going to get worse. And I realized that one of the things that helps me take away the stress is realizing that there's nothing new under the sun. So on this podcast, we take the news of the day and we run it through the Bible and other periods in history to realize that we've been through this before and we can rise above again. Politics by Faith, anywhere you listen to the podcast. Politics by Faith.
Welcome back. It's time for today's deep dive. The least discussed of the four current criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump, from my perspective, is the case in my state, the state of Florida. This is the first of the two federal prosecutions that was brought by special counsel Jack Smith last year in 2023 pertaining to the classified documents dispute at Mar-a-Lago, which ultimately has as its point of public provenance the pre-dawn raid in Mar-a-Lago back in August of 2022. And this is the prosecution on Espionage Act grounds of all such charges. That's the World War I statute that Jack Smith is tangentiously and, I would argue, irresponsibly invoking to try to push these charges. This is the prosecution pertaining to the fact that Donald Trump apparently took various classified documents, top secret documents, national security implicating documents back to Mar-a-Lago without much or any explanation, without any kind of public action. And if you believe the facts of the Jack Smith indictment, which you should obviously take with a grain of salt because it is just the prosecutor's view of the case, but if you do that, then he even ignored grand jury subpoenas. He was moving documents around, trying to hide them from cameras, all this sort of stuff there. And one of the leading arguments all along, as we've discussed here in America on Trial with Josh Hammer, one of the leading arguments that I have gravitated towards that my good buddy Mike Davis of the Article 3 Project, who is a vocal kind of pro-Trump lawyer and legal activist, one of the major arguments that Mike and I have both been making in our own respective capacities is that there is another governing statute that probably governs the conduct at issue here. The Espionage Act was a statute passed in the World War I era. It was upheld in a very debatable, arguably incorrect decision called Schenck back in the early 20th century. I personally don't have a huge issue with Schenck for what it's worth because I'm not exactly a civil libertarian free speech absolutist, but a lot of those types, the Jonathan Turley, Alan Dershowitz types, have a huge issue with Schenck and with the Espionage Act in general. In any event, the argument that Mike Davis and I and others like us have been making is that the Espionage Act has nothing whatsoever to do with this, has literally nothing to do with this, and is almost assuredly unconstitutional, maybe not facially speaking, but at a bare minimum as applied to a former president of the United States, for goodness sake. And here, what we have argued is that there is a different statute, a civil statute, not a criminal statute, called the Presidential Records Act, which was actually passed in the late 1970s, around the time of the Jimmy Carter era, part of the post-Watergate fallout. And we've argued that it is this statute, the Presidential Records Act, which is, it's a civil statute, not a criminal statute, that governs the relations for what records presidents can take after their time in office. So the Presidential Records Act defines and states public ownership of the records. It places the responsibility for the custody and management of presidential records with the president. It allows the president to dispose of records that he no longer... You know, there are a lot of things that this statute does. The point is that this is the relevant, directly on-point statute that has to do with how presidents retain their records after the time in office and the inevitable back and forth that every president has with the National Archives when it comes to what records are going to go with the president, what are going to go to the National Archives, what records are going to ultimately be stored for a presidential library one day, as virtually every modern or modern-ish president has had and probably will have for the foreseeable future, and so forth. Well, finally yesterday, on Thursday, April 4th, in the courtroom of Judge Aileen Cannon in Fort Pierce, Florida, we actually got a ruling on the Presidential Records Act. Now, it's a very brief ruling. It is a terse ruling. It's only 3 pages long. And in this 3-page ruling, Judge Aileen Cannon said that she is not going to dismiss the indictment for now based on the Presidential Records Act. However, she went ahead and preserved the possibility of Donald Trump and his lawyers actually raising this as a substantive defense during trial, very similar to what we were just discussing, actually, when it came to what Judge Scott McAfee did in his own Fulton County, Georgia case pertaining to the free speech defense. Now, it is interesting that even though Jack Smith was pushing, the special counsel for Merrick Garland, Jack Smith, he was pushing Judge Cannon to actually go ahead and definitively deny once and for all the Presidential Records Act as a possibility that could ever be raised whatsoever. He really wanted the judge to go ahead and just quash this thing, nip it in the bud, and to say, oh, this is garbage, you can never go ahead and raise this. She didn't do that. So any fair reading of this 3-page ruling, I think, would make clear that she's basically saying that there is no pretrial basis. There is no pretrial basis to dismiss counts 1 through 32 of the Jack Smith indictment there at the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. But Donald Trump is fully free to raise this thing during trial. And I anticipate that he will do so. The question right now with the Florida case is what the timeline looks like. As we discussed on this show, when you have classified documents like this, it's going to be procedurally arcane. There's all sorts of various protections that have to be put in place to make sure the classified documents don't get out there in discovery, aren't going to get out there in a full jury trial, but you also have to get some of it out there because you have Sixth Amendment, confrontation clause rights, due process clause rights. So it's all a bit of a procedural mess. So right now, it looks more likely than not, if I had to guess, that this trial is going to commence at some point late summer into early fall. But further delays are certainly not inconceivable. And I think it remains certain at the end, I think it remains likely at the end of the day that we are certainly not going to get a verdict in this case before November. But for now, just know that Judge Eileen Cannon has finally weighed in on the Presidential Records Act claim. She has merely said that while there is no pretrial basis to dismiss this indictment on Presidential Records Act grounds, there does remain the possibility that Trump and his lawyers can actually raise this during trials. Fascinating stuff there, I thought, from Judge Eileen Cannon. That's it for today's deep dive. Up next in today's closing argument, what's going on with Joe Biden and Bibi Netanyahu and this terrible story in Gaza? A lot going on there. We'll unpack it all for you when we come back. Welcome back. It's time for today's closing argument. So by now, you've probably heard of the fact that there was a terrible tragedy. There was an incident in Gaza earlier this week, around Monday or so, where Jose Andres, the left-wing Looney Tune of a celebrity chef in Washington, D.C., he has a humanitarian aid organization called World Central Kitchen, and he apparently decided as a way of trying to gin up favor for himself, or really as a publicity stunt, he decided that he was going to send some aid workers into harm's way and put them into Gaza to try to deliver aid to Gazans who have been displaced as a result of Israel's righteous prosecution of its defensive war effort against the Hamas jihadist organization in the aftermath of the Hamas Holocaust of October 7, 2023. And seven of these Jose Andres-backed aid workers earlier this week were tragically taken out in what can only be described as just a serious, serious blunder. And just this morning, overnight, the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, following an internal investigation, did indeed identify two officers in its military who were responsible for the strike, and they described it as a, quote, serious failure, and they went ahead and dismissed. They went ahead and dismissed the officers in question, so they are no longer going to be working in any capacity for the IDF over the remainder of this military effort to exterminate the Hamas jihadist organization. Now, that raises the overarching question, though, is mistakes, obviously, tragic mistakes happen all the time. There are tragically civilians killed in virtually every war that has ever been fought in the history of wars. And in fact, in Newsweek, where I work, we publish a number of op-eds now from John Spencer, who is the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He is one of the top experts on urban warfare in the country, if not the world. He has been on the, he was on the ground in Mosul in Iraq during the American counterinsurgency against ISIS there around 2016 or so. Just to put some teeth on this, according to John Spencer's crunching of the numbers, the ratio of combatants to civilians killed in Gaza is about 1 to 1.5. Now, according to John Spencer, the UN, the European Union, and other sources typically estimate that civilians usually account for 80 to 90% of casualties in modern warfare. So that would be a not 1 to 1.5 ratio, a 1 to 9 ratio. And he also says that during the Battle of Mosul, which, again, as I mentioned, he supervised the counterinsurgency against ISIS in 2016 to 2017, the ratio there was about 10,000 civilians compared to 4,000 ISIS terrorists. So that is a worse ratio as well as what the IDF is currently doing in Gaza. All of that is to say that all the people that are wetting their panties and getting all their panties up in a wad over this, you need to have some perspective. Is every innocent life lost a tragedy? Yes, unambiguously so. We are all children made in the eyes of God. It's an obvious tragedy, and Israel has done what every first world military would do, which is run up the food chain, have an investigation, and hold accountable those who grievously erred. That is exactly what they have done. What more could you possibly want them to do short of a standard of literal perfection that is suitable for no one other than God Almighty himself? I simply do not understand. Anyway, that's it for today's episode of America on Trial with Josh Hammer. Thanks, as always, for tuning in, folks. We'll be right back on Monday with more. I hope you enjoy your weekend.